for those of you who have been listening for at least 45 minutes or so, you know that Beaver Harris expected to come into the studio before 11, and he is here. And by way of introduction, let me just mention this, that from the liner notes of this Laroque Paris album, 1966, Joachim Ernst Behrendt, the author of the jazz book From New Orleans to Fusion and Beyond, had this to say about Beaver Harris. He can be considered the most important link in that special development which led to the kind of drumming that enthuses so many people right now. I'm talking about Shannon Jackson, the drummer who freed funk the way Elvin freed bebop. Harris stands in a similar relationship to Shannon, as does Philly Joe Jones to Elvin. And that's a quote from Joachim Ernst Behrendt about William Beaver Harris, who is our special guest in the studio right now. How you doing, Beaver?
Fine. How are you, Elliot?
Okay.
Good.
All right. Good to have you up here.
It's good to be here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And an essential part of the Albert Eiler legacy, your music with him. Yes.
Yeah, well, he was a great, great leader and a great person. And it's hard to find fault. And he was just a very good man, you know. I was in the service with him. And
Yeah, tell us about that, how you first met Albert.
Well, I was in Fort Knox, Kentucky in 1957 to 59, excuse me. And Albert Eiler came into the service, I guess, around 1958. Mm-hmm. And he had to come through Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I remember when he did arrive, he did join in the band. Mm-hmm. He did join the band right away. And I met him. I was in special services playing baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And through being in special services playing baseball, I was able to hang out with the band most of the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when Albert came in and he had his high heel Cuban heel shoes on.
Too much.
And, you know, he had a red sport coat and, you know, a nice pair of pants. And he had this premature gray streak of hair.
In his beard.
And also, I think, in his head up top there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was rare seeing this person at that time in 57 to see a person, you know, it was like the way that people are dressing now. He was more or less, he had that same look back then.
So ahead of his time and sharp.
Well, yes, I met him then.
Right.
And later I found, you know, that Albert, his family, they owned a very, very large house in Shaker Heights in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's somewhat of a residential or affluent type neighborhood.
Right.
And I did go and stay at his home later on in our career, playing together. And he studied and played a lot. And I remember hearing him in the band. And I could tell immediately that he had something different because his tone was so large.
Right.
And that was our first meeting, just hearing this sound, and I kind of zeroed in on that sound, and it was Albert Eiler.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to hang out together, and I was playing ball, which means that I had to go and play ball, and we somewhat parted. I think they shipped him to Europe, and we did play together. We will get to that in the service a little bit. And
okay.
He was somewhat annoyed with the way that the guys were playing in the Army, and we had guys like Stanley Turrentine.
He was in the band.
Jimmy DuCrease.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they had two different bands. They had the, I forget the names of the band, like numbers, 147 band and another band.
Right.
Stanley Turrentine was in the other band. And, they had Jimmy DuCrease, Marian Anderson's nephew, great classical composer.
Mm-hmm.
And we would all jam and play. Matter of fact, that's when I bought my drums then.
Uh-huh.
And
so that's when you were first starting to play drums.
I had started to play before, but that was the first set of drums that I'd owned. It was in 1958. Mm-hmm. And I was the male clerk.
Mm-hmm.
From playing baseball, they would put you into a special division. Like, And you had to have an MOS, which means that's a job title.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a supply clerk and a mail clerk, and I had the mail room, and I put my drums in the mail room, and I would practice all the time. So one thing led to another, and Albert would come around, and we would just sit, the two of us sit and talk and play together. And that was the way that I met him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now, one thing that is interesting in looking at the development of Albert Eiler, we know that early in his musical career as a teenager,
yeah,
he played a lot of rhythm and blues gigs, you know, traveling around Ohio and the Midwest. And also, he was known, he grew up, of course, playing spirituals in
that's
church,
right,
that his parents attended.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also known as one of the best saxophonists in his area for playing anything, whether it was blues, spirituals, or bebop.
Oh, yeah, he had a natural, I guess he was just a natural horn player, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a large tone, and I'm sure this is the reason why John Coltrane dug him.
Right.
Was because he had quite a large tone and full control of the instrument. And he, you know, he did study. Like I said, his parents, they evidently made it possible for the two boys to study when mm-hmm. they were, you know, growing up.
Right.
So as a man, it was easy for him to achieve, evidently, what he had achieved, mm-hmm. you know, through the training that he had had.
Right. Now, when you first heard him, was he, how much did he sound like the Albert Eiler that we've known, you know, come to know on records? Or was he still playing then more in a, you know, more rhythm and blues, more bebop back in the 50s?
Well, I think that he had what we would call a jazz concept.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, in the early 40s, going into the 50s, I guess guys, they had a great deal of respect for spirituals, the blues,
mm-hmm.
and on. And evidently that is what enabled for them to be great musicians, that they understood mm-hmm. their roots. And Albert also understood his roots.
The same.
He understood the spirituals and the blues, and he was like more or less a honky-tonk type player.
Mm-hmm.
And he could play, you know, all day long and all night, and he knew exactly where he would like to be on his instrument. So mm-hmm. it was more or less a natural evolution for him to play the way that he ended up playing, because he could play so much.
I see.
He was so good mm-hmm. in different areas that he possibly couldn't find which one he wanted to go into. Mm-hmm. But he had the jazz roots, you know. He mm-hmm. was what we consider jazz, a jazz player. He was more or less that type player. He would improvise and try things, and he, mm-hmm. you know, was perfecting the big sound,
mm-hmm.
you know, the big Coleman Hawkins and
Prez.
And he understood all these great musicians, and, you know, Louis Armstrong. I mean, he mm-hmm. understood all of the music connotations, you know. And
right.
he mm-hmm. He was just a different type of person at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I guess to have had the opportunity to study, like I'm sure that he did study,
mm-hmm.
maybe he felt that in order to change
mm-hmm.
the music so that he could join in,
mm-hmm.
because of his greatness, evidently, at the peak where he did join,
mm-hmm.
he had to probably do something a little different.
Uh-huh. Something no one else had done.
Right. And mm-hmm. I guess I'm somewhat putting this together. I guess from the way that he would play the marches and the different things in the band and the army,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was louder than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel a sense of swing.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the thing that is really different about the way that our music has evolved. It's there isn't too much different in terms of Louis Armstrong's music being any different from Albert's music, except that the time is mm. different, and the people, they were around different things through radio and just on their own. They were able to hear it more,
right.
and they could utilize everything that they heard. So he was only utilizing what he had heard,
I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you did get a chance to play with him while you were in the Army together.
Well, yes, we played mm-hmm. together a lot. And like I said, that was my first, that was my beginning mm-hmm. in a sense. I mean, I could play. I always could play. But I was into baseball.
Right.
You see, so I had made up my mind.
And so forth.
And, but then after Albert and Stanley Turrentine and some of the guys mm-hmm. whom I've met, they really inspired me to go on into the music thing. So evidently he was that great of a person, because mm-hmm. I was inspired
to continue.
To continue, you know, and to get out of baseball, mm-hmm. which is a long story, but
right.
and to go out into music, because I could feel that there was room in his type music mm-hmm. for the new breed, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe also Charles Tyler was he there?
Well, no. See, Albert was the only person in the service that I'd met back then. Tyler, people like Tyler and even his brother Don, I hadn't met them.
Okay.
And not only that, I doubt if Tyler had anything to musically to do with Albert at that time.
Okay.
Yeah, because Albert was more or less a very personal, you know, type person. He was more or less alone.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't see him again for years after that.
No, I hadn't seen Albert, I guess, from 58 to 64.
Okay. So by the time you saw him again, he was Albert Isler.
He had fully blossomed into the Albert Isler that we all know.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think did you follow directly Lionel Shannon Jackson in Albert's band?
Well, no, Ronald Jackson he hadn't worked with Albert then. So okay. Yeah, I'd worked long before Jackson and all of them, you know. Mm-hmm. Sonny Murray was the only person that I had
at that
heard
time.
Of.
Okay.
And in New York City, I mean, Sonny was the person who, and Milford Graves, evidently, mm-hmm. they were the drummers who Albert had to lean towards because mm-hmm. when I came to New York, I was more or less into jazz as we know jazz to be.
Mm-hmm. You know. Traditional, more traditional.
Well, like I said, he had the traditional feeling, but he wanted to expand upon it and utilize different musics.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was totally into jazz from the Louis Armstrong or the Scott Joplin thing to the avant-garde that
right.
way.
I see.
But, we, you know, it's funny that we did meet. We met in New York City at the Village Gate.
Uh-huh.
Years ago in New York, you know, all the bands used to work at the Village Gate, mm-hmm. and I had done a thing with Gratian Moncur there,
right.
and I think they had John Coltrane's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was this album that we had done. The
That's the New Breed in Jazz.
The New Wave in Jazz.
Yeah, right, that double album.
A double okay. album, and that's, John Coltrane, think, and
yeah.
They had...
Shep's band was there, too?
Yeah, Archie Shep's mm-hmm. band, and they had...
I think Mary Baraka had something to do with putting it together.
Yes, I think, well, back in the mm-hmm. 60s, Baraka was responsible for the cultural program that we had in Harlem.
Right.
He was somewhat, you know, instrumental in getting that together, and he had represented the avant-garde with the Impulse people, evidently,
mm-hmm.
and that's how that was set up, you know.
Okay. So that's when you ran into Albert again
yeah,
in New York?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And instantly he mm-hmm. said, I want you to play with me.
Really?
And it's funny because it was a continuation from what we had talked about in the Army, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I was more or less odd to him because I was playing baseball.
Right.
And that was like a prestigious type thing, you know, the big time jock
right.
on post.
Right.
And to me, he was this big-time horn player that I'd never heard, you know, anyone play that much
mm-hmm.
with so much authority, you know.
Yeah.
So we did draw towards one another, and then, like I said, he had to leave to go to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing that next time that I saw Albert was at the Village Gates.
Okay.
During mm-hmm. this program, and
right.
instantly we were thinking somewhat the same, but it goes to show how jazz is. It covers a lot of territory, and mm-hmm. you can look at it from any angle, but it depends on your own abilities, how great that you are. And evidently, Albert was a very great musician. You know?
Okay, mm-hmm. I got it. So that's 64, 65. And then the recordings that we have of you with Albert, they're all live, all from 66 and 67.
That's right.
And now, I guess, well, before we... we're going to go back to music, but before we do that, I do want to mention one thing. That's that we're going to go to the album. As I mentioned before, the Village Concerts double album was not issued by Impulse till 78, but originally back in the late 60s, they did issue parts of those concerts, an album called Albert Island, Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
And Nat Hentoff wrote the liner notes for that. In the liner notes, he mentions that at the Village Vanguard performances, December 1866, John mm-hmm. Coltrane was in attendance.
Well, yeah, when we recorded mm-hmm. the album at the Village Vanguard, Train had, he was at the club, and mm-hmm. it was funny because I had met John Coltrane a couple of years before, evidently, and I'd met him in Pittsburgh when he had come through with Miles Davis's band, and then I saw him again in New York City, and I guess I was working with Sonny Rollins, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
Well, that was my first experience in New York, mm-hmm. and then from Sonny to Archie,
mm-hmm.
and then from Archie to Albert, that type mm-hmm. transition, and Train did come to the club, and he was really interested in hearing,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure he was interested in hearing how I would sound with Albert Eiler.
I see.
Because, you know, at that time, I remember Train was in the midst of changing his band.
Mm-hmm.
And he was such a nice man, he probably didn't want to interfere with groups, you know, I mean, just by walking in and saying, well, I would like to use you in my group. Mm-hmm. So he more or less would come and listen, right. evidently, and he said some beautiful things to me, and
you did get a chance to play with Train too.
Oh yeah. But it wasn't like I had expected. You know, I remember years ago it was after Elvin, I more or less could have been the natural drummer to fall into mm-hmm. the Train group.
Right.
And when Train had his somewhat an audition with different drummers at the same Village Gate.
Mm-hmm.
Rashi, you know, I asked him to sit in, and Rashi would let me sit in, which I don't blame him, because he really wanted, you know,
the gig, right?
He wanted the gig, and he did an excellent job. But then later on, we did end up working together, but by that time, I had joined Archie's group, and I wanted to help and develop that type of music also, you know?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But so, Train was in the club, and he had gotten real fat at the time. And
mm-hmm. Less than a year before he died.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. the sad part about the whole thing, was that I had seen Train go from an average-sized person to this mm-hmm. obese-type man, and he was very sick, and he did come out to hear us, and mm-hmm. he did pay me a very beautiful compliment, which I will always remember.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we are talking with Beaver Harris, who, as he's mentioned, worked not only with Albert Eiler, but also with many other jazz greats. And I guess no other drummer can make the claim that during their first 10 years on the scene, they were able to, and I mean that in every way of able, capable, privileged, and an important part of the music of such figures as Albert Eiler, Sonny Rollins, and Thelonious Monk, and also performances of John Coltrane. And Beaver Harris, here in the studio with us for about half an hour more as well. We're going to listen to more of his contributions with the Albert Eiler's band as we go right now back to 1966, live in the Village Vanguard. And how about this? Let's hear Truth Is Marching In. It's Albert Eiler on tenor sax, Beaver Harris on drums, Donald Eiler on trumpet, Michelle Sampson on violin, Bill Farwell bass, Henry Grimes also on bass. I'm Elliot Bratton. You're listening to WKCR-FM New York. It's the Albert Eiler birthday broadcast. Yes, indeed, that was Truth Is Marching In. Truth Is Marching In by Albert Eiler. Albert Eiler on tenor sax, Donald Eiler on trumpet, Michelle Sampson, violin, Bill Farwell, and Henry Grimes on acoustic basses, and our guest in the studio now, the drummer, Beaver Harris. Beaver Harris was on drums. That taken from the album Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village, and that released back in the 60s, recorded live at the Village Vanguard, that track anyway, recorded live at the Village Vanguard, December of 1966, with John Coltrane in the audience, and Truth Is Marching In. I should mention also something that Beaver Harris and I were talking about off mic is you mentioned that the first time you met Albert, how he was dressed, how sharp, and the photos on this album, on the album Prophecy,
yes.
You can see how sharp a dresser he was.
That's right. He was the leader of how people are dressing now. It's funny, like in the 60s when we were in England,
mm-hmm.
The Beatles evidently had fallen in love with this man, Albert Eiler, you know.
Okay.
And we were going to do it. We were supposed to do a television thing. And we were also, they were trying to set us up where we could work in Ronnie Scott's club. I mean, instantly, they you know, they heard that we were there, mm-hmm. and they wanted Albert Eiler to play for the people. And
really?
I understood that the Beatles, I mean, they really loved Albert Eiler in every attempt mm-hmm. possible. I mean, you know, they tried to get to see him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
they did hear some of your performances, your live performances in Europe.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure mm-hmm. that they heard them. And mm-hmm. also George Hamilton, this movie star, he
right.
was in the, this film star, this actor,
right.
or whatever they call it, that type thing. He was in the studio when we were going to do a TV thing. And I noticed that he was really fascinated by Albert. You know? Albert was quite a guy, you know.
Right.
And it's funny, you would think that the attention would have been on George Hamilton, but it
right.
was almost like Albert was so, you know, he was neatly dressed and very, mm-hmm. you know, avant-garde-like mm-hmm. in his dress. But, you know.
And magnetic. It was magnetic.
That's right. Yeah. He had this magnetic thing and with that premature gray hair and mm-hmm. neatly shaved and everything and with his high heel shoes. you
right.
know. So he was a little different, but it was funny. Back then, we used to go on the George Wein tours with, mm-hmm. you know, Max Roach and his bands mm-hmm. and Sonny Rollins and...
Mm-hmm. And Papa Joe Jones.
Papa Joe Jones mm-hmm. and Illinois Jacket and...
Okay.
Roy Eldridge and mm-hmm. Baby Lawrence. I mean, the bunch of people on this tour. I mean, it was like the greatest talent. Baby, Willie the Lion Smith.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, maybe Sarah Vaughan and uh-huh. Ella Fitzgerald and just all of these great talents.
Mm-hmm.
And not once had I heard anyone say anything negative about Albert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like his music was so different, but evidently everyone could feel that it was all a part of what they were about.
Mm-hmm.
And along with playing this type of music with Albert, I guess the change was so different to a lot of the musicians and that they did appreciate it and respect it. And they also, I remember Joe Jones saying something to me about the respect that I would get. He said, you're getting more respect than I am getting, you know. And I, you know, I said, well, you know, you're the master drummer, I guess, it's,
right.
Because of what I'm doing, you know. And mm-hmm. But it was in, you know, just and he was informing me of how he was receiving what we were doing.
I see.
And, I remember once I had to have the drums nailed down because we would play so long and so hard that mm-hmm. the drums would fly all over the place and mm-hmm. cymbals and everything, and they had to nail the drums, you know, to the floor.
Uh-huh.
And then
I
think we were in Sweden or someplace, and
uh-huh.
they didn't want to nail the drums into the concert hall. And, you know, Albert said, well, we're not going to perform until, you know, it's done right. And I told mm-hmm. him, I said, listen, I can't play with the drums sliding around.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to put weights on the drums and everything. And
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden I heard this voice. That's right, Youngblood, tell them about it. They never would do that for me. And it was Joe Jones, you know.
About that.
So, you know, there was an evolution in the way that we were treated,
yes.
opposed to the way that they had treated some of our great musicians in the past. So
right.
mm-hmm. it was very much in touch with our reality, you know,
mm-hmm.
respect and everything.
Okay. And Joe Jones and others on the tour had an appreciation for what you were doing.
Oh, they loved it. You know, I mean, it's funny. They used to sit and watch. Like, I remember one time I hit the cymbal and it flew off the cymbal stand and
mm-hmm.
Illinois and Roy Eldridge and all these guys. Every now and then when I see them, they still talk about how hard that I had hit that cymbal. And to see that cymbal fly out in the audience, I mean, you know.
That's something else.
You know, I mean, it's just beautiful. Like these old masters, they're in touch with mm-hmm. the music, and not once had I heard them complain, you know, that it was mm-hmm. nothing.
Okay.
Or that it was, you know.
Right. I also had heard a rumor that the Beatles, and probably John Lennon in particular, who was one of the more, or most, perhaps, open-minded,
yeah.
and also more spiritually oriented of the group,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps wanted to do something actually in terms of recording with Albert.
I had heard that he was really interested in Albert Eiler, and
mm-hmm.
I hadn't, personally, I hadn't heard that, but I'm sure that it seems like it could have happened.
Okay.
Because Albert was like their hero. I mean, he had, you know, he was the most different music out there at that time. Evidently, the Beatles had heard, you know, some of the music, our music, prior to Albert.
Right.
And evidently, they had wanted to get as close as possible to the music or the musicians, and Albert was more or less their hero, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, we're going to go to music from European tour in 66.
Mm-hmm.
And before we do that, though, I want you to give any recollections. This is going to be from the Salle Pleyel, which, of course, held was the place that held many great concerts Dizzy Gillespie and others have made over the years. And it's in Paris at the Paris Jazz Festival, November 13, 1966. Radio France recorded this live.
Yeah.
And any recollections about that concert?
Well, that's strange. Well, at that time, we had gotten everything so organized and together that everything just worked very smoothly, you know.
Okay.
And I hadn't known that these tapes were recorded.
Right. You expressed that this is the first time you ever saw
the first time that I've ever seen that jacket and that music there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that they have, you know, many, many tapes, because everything that Albert did, they, you know, everyone, the press and everything, they were all there, you know.
Okay.
And the fact that he was playing European-type music, you know.
Because the marches were in there and everything,
you know, and like I said, in the Army, he could play a march like no other horn player, you know.
How
he would make it swing. So it's, you know.
How about that?
Yeah.
So, we got to go to the Salle Pleyel in Paris, the Paris Jazz Festival, November 13, 66. It's during the tour. The tour had started, I guess, a week or two before, before November 13, 66. And these recordings just issued last year by the Hat Art label, part of a box set of, it's really, actually, it's really two album set, but it's in a box. Called Albert Eiler, La Rock, Paris, 1966. Music from that European tour that Beaver Harris has just been talking about. Beaver Harris with us in the studios. My name is Elliot Bratton. This is WKCR-FM New York, the Albert Eiler birthday broadcast, a special that's going until 5 a.m. tomorrow morning. And we're going to hear a tune from the last side of the album, called Divine Peacemaker. It's listed as Holy Family on the album, but that title is actually incorrect. It is Divine Peacemaker, an Albert Eiler composition. Albert Eiler's tenor sax, Beaver Harris on drums, Donald Eiler on trumpet, Michelle Sampson violin, and William Falwell, Bill Falwell on bass. And that was Divine Peacemaker. It's listed incorrectly as Holy Family on the album. Holy Family does appear actually on the other side of the record in the two record set, but that was Divine Peacemaker, an Albert Eiler composition, and Albert Eiler, of course, on tenor saxophone, Donald Eiler trumpet, Michelle Sampson violin, Bill Falwell bass, and Beaver Harris on drums, from the two record set, which is a box set though, just released last year by Hat Art, called Albert Eiler in the La Rock and Paris, 1966. The tune we just heard, Divine Peacemaker, recorded by Radio France in Paris during the Paris Jazz Festival in 1966, November of 66. Beaver Harris with us in the studio and has a little bit more time to spend with us. It's almost getting close to 20 before the hour of noon. And we'll talk a little bit more about working with Albert Eiler. And let's see. One thing I do want to ask, though, while it's right on top of my head, forefront of my mind, is what happened to Michelle Sampson and Bill Falwell? Any idea?
Well, that's funny. After the Albert Eiler days, I haven't seen Michelle Sampson, not even once.
Really?
And I saw Bill Falwell one time. I think he had moved to Las Vegas or something.
I know he did play with Albert, you know, in the, like, his last albums. I think Bill Falwell's on it.
And I hadn't heard or seen these two guys since that time, you know.
Really?
It's strange, you know.
Yeah.
I guess Michael Sampson was a very he was an excellent classical musician.
And he's from Europe.
Yeah, he was originally, I think, from Holland, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And he had come here, I think they were playing in Cleveland, Ohio, Albert's hometown. And evidently they were traveling around after their performance and they heard Albert.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And
he was with a classical concert band.
He was with, yeah.
I see.
And they were playing in Cleveland, evidently. Mm-hmm. I think that is the way that the story goes. And
how about that?
He heard Albert and just put down the group and stayed with Albert. Mm-hmm. He defected his group, I guess. and joined the forces. But, and Bill Falwell, I hadn't heard from him at all, you know, except for the one time, I think, maybe many years ago, I saw him one day, and we were talking about the times that, you know, we had played together, and that was that. But it's funny, these musicians have disappeared, and I haven't seen anyone of them. I every now and then, Don Isla will pop up, you know, he'll come to town, and I don't know where from. I think Cleveland.
Right, maybe.
Because he was pretty out there when I met him, you know.
right. One thing I have to talk about is the fact that now Albert, his very first recordings, there is some of the spiritual concerns, you know, the titles and so forth. Some of that is there. Then from 1964, when he really started recording on a regular basis, and shortly before you ran into him again, he started to make just about all of his song titles had to do with spirituality. And his music, two things that grew out of this, two questions, I guess. Did he ever talk about why he used, you know, additional strings, an additional bass, the violin, the cello? And also, did he talk to, you know, you as a band member about his spiritual concepts a lot?
Well, it's funny. We played in Cleveland, Ohio, his hometown. And I stayed at his mother and dad's house there. And they were very highly religious people. I mean, you know, and evidently they had owned a church or they were part of a church. And you know, their whole life, their lives, as I understand it, was based upon spirituality, you know, like everything was based on that. And, you know, Albert's mother would go into a trance type thing every now and then, you know, she would get maybe carried away and she would somewhat get into this heavy trance type
speaking
thing.
Speaking in tongues and so forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they all had respect for her. You know, she was crippled.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was a crippled woman, and the dad would carry her around, and he was a very dedicated man, you know. And but the load of carrying her and doing for the family and this highly religious thing possibly was a little too much for him, you know, because, I mean, it was really highly religious-like. And they would have visions and different things, so a lot of what Albert was doing was natural to him.
I see.
But it was odd to people around him. And it wasn't that odd to me. You know, I had to... I could have rejected it or accepted it, and my grandparents, they were somewhat sanctified, and they had a church in Pittsburgh. So I know for how that type thing can happen in the musicality that comes from that. You know, I mean, there's some heavy music that comes from that type mentality. You know, they go into
so that made all of the arrangements necessary with the strings and so forth. That was the quality he was looking for.
Well, I think with the strings, it had something to do with also, if you notice, his music is, it is like a drone. It goes into a, it's more or less like a chant or a repeat of a theme.
Right.
And when you play that, and just in technical terms, evidently, the drone or the chant or the vamp or whatever you'd call it, it more or less stays in one place, but it evolves out of that one point, you know.
So the strings added that. And
it gives a feeling of the ghosty, somewhat the, I guess, the mysterious type feeling. So I guess, and then, you know, like I said, he had a little of the classical thing, I guess, going in his mind also. You know, he figured that he had to utilize certain instruments in order to get his feeling across. And right. evidently the strings had a lot to do with his feelings, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did he talk about his spiritual concepts to you much?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, mm-hmm. it was an open thing. Everything was mm-hmm. based upon, you know, the biblical mm-hmm. connotations mm-hmm. as we right. know them, you know. And, you know, I can relate to it because, like I said, my grandmother, they had the same type thing going on, mm-hmm. you see. And it's good. It's very good, you know. And but you can get carried away with this thing. Mm-hmm. If you don't know how to control it, you can go beyond mm-hmm. what is expected of you.
True.
And it can become weird to others.
Right.
And evidently, at times, I think it did appear to come across as being weird.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, he would snap out of it, and he was just, you know, a normal person. I mean, they would really speak about some way out things at times,
okay.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to go to, I guess, the last, or next to last track of this segment of the broadcast, Light and Darkness,
mm-hmm.
from the Village Concerts double album. This also recorded live in Greenwich Village
mm-hmm.
at the Village Theater, in this case, in 67. And this is something from a jazz director now who put this together, really, Andy Rotman. He and I both agree that this tenor sax solo that Albert Isler takes here is the most extraordinary mm-hmm. tenor sax solo that we've ever heard on record. And one reason why is that Albert is he is speaking in tongues, really, with the tenor sax in his mouth and in his hands.
Yes.
And no one else, you know, has done anything like this before or since.
Oh, he could chant and yeah mm-hmm. through the horn.
Right.
He was really different. Yeah.
Now, the question that Andy Robert had for you, since you were there, you played, mm-hmm. you're there playing drums on Light and Darkness, was it as extraordinary? How did it feel? You know, it's extraordinary for us to listen to this. This is something mm-hmm. else altogether. Was it that extraordinary playing, you know?
Well, you know, I can relate it to, evidently, I hate to, you know, keep using certain terms, but yeah. I don't know any other terms mm-hmm. to use. Like, okay. I guess in classical music, there's like a chant,
mm-hmm.
you know, a do-mi-so type mm-hmm. vamp that, they, you know, they mm-hmm. tend to stick around.
Uh-huh.
They stay, you know, from that do-mi-so type uh-huh. mentality. And it's like a continuous vamp.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in church, in the European churches, they somewhat sing out of that do me so chant right. all the way through their whole sermon, evidently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that it was related to the classical connotation of the do me so type mm-hmm. chant, but he was using possibly his own language or his own
right.
experiences
I see.
In his chant. But he definitely had a reason for doing it, and
right.
I relate it to that because of the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And because of some of his awareness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was more or less, had something to do with the church, probably.
Yeah.
European yeah. or, you know, African, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. How did you have to change, though, in terms of your drumming to not only keep up with, but then contribute and make original contributions to his music?
Well, now, that's a good point, because what happens in jazz is you give to jazz what you feel
mm-hmm.
that it needs. Each tune can be played by a different group, and it mm-hmm. comes out differently.
Right.
So after knowing the composer, you tend to look into his music, and you search for what you feel it needs based mm-hmm. upon how you conceive him, how you receive this person. And I had vowed to myself to try to be as rhythmical as possible in drumming and developing.
Right.
I wanted to be that way. So it was a good, it was a chance for me to really, you know, exploit all of these different rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a continuous flow of rhythms that I had to play, and also keep the melodic figure in mind. You know, I c- couldn't get lost.
Right.
And that was interesting because everything that I played, I mean, it was related to that melody, no matter how way out or how dissonant or whatever it may sound, it was related. And, you know, so it was fun. It was fun, and it was a part of, like, my growth of the 60s, you know. It was like the free movement type thing, and it was helpful for me,
Okay. And I guess I'll ask the question before we go to Light and Darkness. You mentioned that you also attended John Coltrane's funeral.
Yes.
And how much of a blow Train's death was to, you know, the jazz world in general, and particularly to Albert, since they were close musically and also his friends. And Albert, I know Albert and also Ornette had a group that played at the funeral at St. Peter's. And you also mentioned, I know he's later split with his brother Donald after you had finished working with him. And how did those things affect him? And, you know, and do you think that any of those pressures and so forth and feelings in any way contributed to his death, which is still a mystery?
Well, Albert Eiler knew that John Coltrane really loved him. You know, evidently, John Coltrane had said that he felt that Albert was the next horn player in line. Now, as a drummer, it's hard for me to say what he meant by that, because there are some great horn players, but in guessing, I would say that because Albert was so different, and he was searching for, you know, newer ideas along the line that could fit his music, Train was also searching in his music for, you know, for newer ideas.
Right.
So I think Albert felt that he and Train were the two chosen. And Train's death, I'm sure, affected Albert so much that he did feel alone. And it's hard to say that because I know of all of these great horn players. But back at that time, if you were there, you would probably, you could probably relate to it. Evidently, Albert was the most different horn player from Train. Of all of the horn players, Farrell, Shep, and everyone, Albert was the completely the most different horn player on the scene, which made Train really dig him.
Right, and he influenced Train, so.
Yeah, so it was more or less what Train needed, and Albert needed Train, no doubt.
Right.
And Train's death affected Albert to the extent that Albert, I remember hearing him say that, well, I guess it's only me now. You know, that's just like an inside conversation, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I guess he really felt that he was alone.
I see.
And that's probably, at that time, that was a greater responsibility than what we were doing, to have to follow in the footsteps of the masterful John Coltrane, evidently. You know, he also dug Sonny Rollins that way. I mean, I mean, Sonny Rollins was like his real hero.
Right.
You know, I mean, the large tone and the playing different melodies and, you know. So, but Train was the most different horn player that he had heard, evidently, just like Albert was the most different horn player that a lot of people had heard at that time.
Right.
So it made Train and Albert somewhat draw towards one another. You know, even when Train was very sick, he came to the recording session and died shortly after that, and that affected Albert, you know, and like it did affect everyone. But Albert really being highly spiritual and everything based upon, you know, that type mentality, it affected him deeply. And
any thoughts on Albert's death?
I haven't heard anything about, but I've heard stories about different things, but without including anyone else into his death, because I don't know anything about it, I can honestly say that I think the frustrations of, like I said, John Coltrane's death was devastating. It did affect him. And the fact that I feel that he knew that he had to change in order to keep that whole thing going on along with his thing, he couldn't keep his brother with him and do that change. So they were beginning to part, and his mother, through being highly spiritual, thought that Albert was cracking up because of what he had received from the other sound.
not taking in consideration that he was thinking about his guru, his leader, Train.
Uh-huh.
So she would somewhat torment him, and because she wanted for he and Don to play together endlessly, right. You know.
I see.
And Albert wanted to go on, so that did affect him.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So.
So he did. There were a lot of pressures on him.
Definitely, mm-hmm. You know, and he had a girlfriend back then. She would pressure him. You know, mm-hmm. Everyone wanted to be a part of Albert Isle, evidently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. How did you leave Albert's band?
Well, like I said, at first, my first job was with Sonny Rollins.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't like leaving back then. It was like, you know, you would play with different cats, and you would just play, and then you get a call from someone else, and you would play with them. But
because in 1967, I guess, is when you stopped playing with Albert.
Yeah.
Sometime in that
what
year.
Happened, I think, when we had done our tour in 66, George Ween was asking me about the next year,
mm-hmm.
who I thought would be best for him to take to Europe of mm-hmm. the so-called avant-garde players.
Right.
And, you know, not wanting to be partial, I told him that I'm not a spokesman for the avant-garde. I wouldn't know who to say, because there are some great people out there. But I said, I think Archie Shepp it would be a nice addition also.
See.
So he did take Archie in 1967, mm-hmm. and I had worked with Archie before Albert.
Uh-huh.
So I had to go back to Europe with Archie.
Right.
So it was just a matter of just moving from one band to mm-hmm. the next. And
right. And that started a more than decade continual, pretty much, association with Archie.
Archie. Shep. We worked right. together for 12 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And
all right.
It was really fun, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Beaver Harris. Let's see who we've been talking with. And we're going to go to our last selection of this portion of the Albert Isler birthday broadcast. And that is Light and Darkness. Again, as you said, a very special, extraordinary piece. The personnel here, Albert Isler, of course, on tenor saxophone, his brother Donald on trumpet, Michelle Sampson on violin, Joel Friedman cello, Bill Farwell and Alan Silva on basses, of course, Beaver Harris on drums, recorded live at the Village Theater in New York City, February 26, 1967, on the ABC Impulse double album, The Village Concerts. And, well, thank you, Beaver Harris.
Thank you, Elliot Bratton.
Okay.
Yeah, it really feels good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the Albert Isler birthday broadcast continues.